You're tuned in to the Kojong Nam, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk with local author Elizabeth White, whose book explores the challenges she went through as a middle-aged person suddenly staring at unemployment. But first, I'd like to share a conversation I had last week with Congressman John Lewis and Andrew Iden, his collaborator, on the graphic novel series called March. We spoke in front of an audience of D.C. students at the Library of Congress Young Readers Center, and while it's fortunate timing that it happened during Black History Month, we also spent a lot of time exploring how that history can shape our understanding of the present. Take a listen.
Could you please welcome Congressman John Lewis? And Andrew Iden. Congressman Lewis, I'll start with you. You've been tireless in your work, not just on this book, but in talking about it with students, with librarians, with journalists. You gave a very moving speech in accepting the National Book Award late last year. What does the recognition this work has received mean to you?
Well, thank you. First of all, Koja, it's good to see you, brother.
Always
good to see you. And thank you for all of the good and great things that you continue to do. It's good to be here at the Library of Congress. Good to see all of you. Beautiful, handsome young people. You look so wonderful. You look so smart. When I go and speak about this book, reread the book, I turn the pages and see certain drawings or images, it takes me back to another part of my life. You know, from reading March, book one, book two, book three, I grew up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. So when I received the honor, along with Andrew Iden and Nate Powell, it was too much. We stood together. And I was lost for words. It took me back to rural Alabama in 1956, when I was 16 years old with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins. We went to a little library to try to get a library card, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for colors. I didn't go back to that library until many, many years later. By this time, I'm in the Congress for book signing. So hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. And after the book signing, after we had some refreshment, they gave me a library card. And to work with Andrew, who was so gifted and so smart, and Nate Powell, it's been a work of love. And to see young people standing in line to get the book, to get the book signed, and to take a seat in the middle of the floor, at a table, a desk, and read the book. And as I travel around America, different places, people come up with the book. So I'm buying this book for my son, and my brother, my nieces, my nephews. Books are powerful. They can take us places that we dare to go.
Well, I'm glad you finally got your library card.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about why this project took the shape that it did as a graphic novel. When did you first encounter a comic that spoke to the civil rights movement?
In late 1957, or either early 1958, I remember reading a comic book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story. It sold for 10 cents. And Andrew would tell you through his research, he discovered that Dr. King helped edit this book. This book became like a roadmap for those of us that got involved in the American Civil Rights Movement. It told the story of Montgomery. It spoke about the way of peace, the way of love, the philosophy of nonviolence, how people organize, how people walk, shared rides in cars, church buses, rather than ride segregated buses in Montgomery. In Montgomery during the 50s, black and white people couldn't be seated together on a city bus. Even here in Washington, D.C., in 1961, during the Freedom Rides, black people and white people couldn't be seated together leaving Washington to travel through Virginia or North Carolina or South Carolina or Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. So public transportation, whether the trains or buses, have been a means of carrying the story in the way of the civil rights movement. It helped to bring down those signs that said white waiting, colored waiting, white men, white women, colored women. And I said to young people all the time, growing up today, you won't see those signs on a bus or on a train or a waiting room. The only place that you'll see those signs today will be in a book, in a museum, or on a video. They're gone, and it's my hope they will never, ever return.
Andrew Iden, despite the fact that the congressman encountered that graphic novel or comic about Dr. King when he was just 17 years old, you still had a little trouble convincing your colleagues and even the congressman himself to write a graphic novel. Why did you think this was the right format for this project?
I grew up in Atlanta. The congressman's been my congressman since I was 3 years old. I went to Atlanta public schools. And I heard the story of the civil rights movement over and over and over again. I heard it in documentaries. I heard it in books. I heard people tell the stories. But to me, I'd grown up reading comics. It was sort of my salvation. It was my refuge, right? My father left when I was 4 or 5 years old, and it was sort of where I turned. I wanted stories of heroes who wanted justice because it was the right thing to do. That summer of the campaign in 2008, Barack Obama sweeping through the Democratic primaries, people in politics were fundamentally reevaluating the way in which they communicate with young people, but with everyone, whether it's the internet, the visual literacy that comes with that, or simply just how you talk to people, like what we're willing to talk about. And so as it came down to the end of that campaign, and the congressman tells me about Martin Luther King and the Montgomery story, I mean, these were two things that were incredibly important in my life. Here I'd spent the whole summer watching John Lewis tell these stories that I had never heard growing up in Atlanta. The story of SNCC, the story of the young people, which was so much different than the story I'd always been told. And at the same time, the congressman was telling me that he read a comic book when he thought about joining the movement. I mean, the 24-year-old nerd just kind of exploded, you know? And it felt like it was okay to be me, right? Like, that, like, oh, maybe it wasn't so weird for me to like comics after all. Maybe it was all the other people who put them down who were wrong. So when I started thinking, you know, there should be a comic book about John Lewis's life, it was, in a sense, to show everyone what I had just seen that summer, what I had witnessed firsthand. And hearing John Lewis tell those stories, seeing him act it out, seeing him in front of you, that was a big part of it for me. And so trying to find a way to capture that experience and put it down on paper, words alone could not do it the justice that it needed.
This trilogy begins as a reflection on the eve of President Obama's inauguration, a reflection on the work you did during the Civil Rights Movement, and it ends, more to come here. Are we in a period now where we're seeing that there's more work to be done here?
In America today, right now, people are saying, where are we going as a nation and as a people? Are we going backward? Are we going to stand still? Or whether we're going to go forward? I think March tells us all that we've come a distance, we've made a lot of progress, but there are forces that want to slow us down or take us back. And We would like for people to be hopeful, to be optimistic, and to understand that we're one people, that it doesn't matter whether we're black or white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American, that we all live in the same house, not just the American house, but the world house. There was a man by the name of A. Philip Randolph that we speak about because he was the man who called together the march on Washington. And he used to say from time to time, maybe our foremothers and our forefathers all came to this great land in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. We have to look out for each other and care for each other. And Dr. King said on one occasion, and he said it so beautifully, that we must learn to live together as one family, as one people. If not, we will perish as fools. And I think this is the message that we try to convey in March.
A. Philip Randolph was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And as Congressman Lewis said, he called the March on Washington together in 1963. Andrew Iden, as you were going through this process with the congressman, that gave you not only a perspective on his life, but did it give you an additional perspective on history that allows you to better interpret the present?
Absolutely. When we first debuted book one, we went to San Diego Comic-Con, which is a more of my people, right? And so we start off, you give a little speech about, you know, this is what my book is about, right? And I said, have any of you guys watched Battlestar Galactica? And, you know, it's Comic-Con, so every hand in the room went up. And I said, well, then, you know, you'll remember. All of this has happened before, and all of this will happen again. And this was in 2013. This was before Ferguson. This was before Eric Garner. This was before the election. This was at a time when I think people thought it was going to be quiet for a while. But the more you understand about John Lewis's story and how much of our politics today are a direct result from forces trying to oppose the progress that he made, the more it seemed like an inevitable conflict was coming. And at the same time, I hope we conveyed the optimism that the activists today need, that the young people that they need. I'll often ask the question or pose it, you know, we have SCLC still. We have the NAACP still. We have the Urban League still. What we don't have today is a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We don't have an organization of young people dedicated to direct action that is completely staffed and organized and run by young people. And so when you look at it in that sort of context today, history is your guide.
There's so much history packed into this trilogy. So many names that jump out at you. Al Lowenstein, Ella Baker, James Forman, Bob Moses, Fannie Lou Hamer. Talk a little bit about any one of those people who our students here might not know about.
I'd go with Ella Baker right off the bat. Yeah, I mean, she was the mother of the movement.
Yep.
and is so pivotal in a way that's not fully understood today. And I hope we conveyed that as much as possible, because she's one of those characters that lives with you through all of the books. She was there at the founding of SNCC, and she was there at the founding of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. She was a keynote speaker at their political convention in August of 1964. She was so important, and I think one of the great tragedies of the history that's been told thus far is that women's roles during the movement have been marginalized. And I think for us, it was so important to correct that, to show women like Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker and Diane Nash and Genevieve Hughes and everybody else who participated in one way or the other, because they so often were the ones who did the nitty-gritty. They didn't push to be the one in the photograph. They pushed to be the one who did the work, who achieved the hardest part.
Fascinating people. When I first came to Washington, among my mentors were people who worked with the congressman and SNCC. And so I knew all of those names, but didn't quite know the details of the history of those individuals. The trilogy helped me to understand that. You know, reading these books, one discovers that you often went against the grain of what others in the movement were doing or wanted to do, skipping the signing ceremony for the Civil Rights Act, keeping the protests going when the so-called Big Six asked you not to, going ahead with the aforementioned Selma to Montgomery March when others in SNCC were against it. And you talk a lot about this idea of good trouble, about standing up for what's right, even when it's not popular, when it's not easy. Where did you get that strength from? What do you want these young people to know about the notion of good trouble? Maybe just as important, how do you know you're getting into the good kind of trouble and not the bad kind?
Well, it's very simple. When I was growing up, and we visit the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery. Troy is about 10 miles from where I grew up. You go downtown Troy, you see the signs that said white and colored. To go to a movie on a Saturday afternoon, all of us looked like children, had to go upstairs to the balcony. And all of the white children went downstairs. I would come home and ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, why? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in trouble. But I heard of Rosa Parks when I was 15 years old. And I met Rosa Parks when I was 17. I heard of Dr. King when I was 15 years old. And I met him when I was 18. It changed my life. And so I was inspired to get in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. And I've been getting in trouble ever since. It's very simple to me. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have an obligation to say something, to do something. We cannot afford to be silent. Because if we're silent, people think you like being mistreated. We have to resist and say, that's not right. That's not fair. That's not just.
For the students in this room who live in the District of Columbia, a city that has no voting rights in Congress, residents of whom many would like to see this as a state, these young people may one day decide to be active now and even more so when they reach voting age. What do you make of these very fundamental questions that persist around the issue of voting rights, not only in the district in a very vivid way, but in a lot of jurisdictions in the United States when it comes to adequate voter representation? The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. And as a resident of the district.
Yeah, I mean, as a D.C. resident, I think it's long overdue that we had full representation in Congress. I don't understand why we can live in this city and pay taxes in this city and, you know, it seems so often that the opponents of voting rights are also the same people who declare their rights based on how much taxes they pay. And yet here we are in the district and we pay quite a bit and we don't have full representation. I think for young people in particular, it's a tremendous opportunity for civil disobedience. I'm just saying, don't tell your teachers. But I think we have to acknowledge the fact that voting rights are under attack all across the country, whether it is fictitious claims that millions of people are voting illegally, which they're not, let's just say it, they're not, or the attempts to make it harder and more difficult for people to register and vote.
Congressman Lewis, today we see a lot of energy, a lot of young people who would like to affect change, but there have been those who say that these current movements lack direction and they lack leadership and cohesion. Some of the things that people said about SNCC back in 1960, as I recall. What is your hope for what these books and for what you can teach this younger generation of activists and protesters?
Well, it is my hope that these books, it boil down to these books being a roadmap, a blueprint. You know, during the 60s, I got arrested a few times 40 times. And since I've been in Congress, another 5 times. My last arrest, this young man had to, I left my money someplace. So he had to lend me.
Spotted you a few dollars.
A few dollars to get out of, to be released. The last arrest took place a short distance from here, over on the Capitol ground, for 200 people, 8 members of Congress. We were trying to get the Speaker of the House to bring forth a comprehensive immigration reform bill. If we had brought the bill to the floor of the House, almost every single member on our side of the aisle would have voted for it, and we would have picked up enough members from the other side, and we would have passed it, and President Barack Obama would have signed it into law. It doesn't make sense for us to have millions of people, especially young people, children, living in fear that something's going to happen to them or to their parents or grandparents. We should set people on the path to citizenship. When the Pope came and spoke to a joint session of the Congress, he said, "We all are immigrants. We all come from some other place." And that will probably be the great debate in the days to come. None of us are really free until all of us are free.
Now it's time for you to ask questions. Anyone? Oh, there's a hand raised up front here.
I didn't do research on you, but was you born like around when Martin Luther King was born, or is he older than you?
Well, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was born in 1929, and I was born in 1940. So in a sense, he was like a big brother. I met him when I was 18 years old. He changed my life. Andrew would tell you that he called me the boy from Troy.
Any other questions from students here? Right here. Yes, ma'am.
The question is for both of you all. You all say a lot about positivity. So do you guys see similarities in today's actions as far as protest than you did in your day?
Well, today, I see similarities. The women marched just a few days, a few weeks ago, whether in Washington, in Atlanta, around the nation, around the world, people are using the same techniques and tactics. I was so proud. I marched with the people in Atlanta. More than 63,000 people showed up. And hundreds and thousands from Atlanta came to Washington. When people showed up at the airport in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion, they learned. They're studying the movement.
You've been listening to selections from a conversation I had last week with Congressman John Lewis and Andrew Iden, his collaborator on the graphic novel series called March. You can check out the video of the entire conversation from that event, which took place at the Library of Congress Young Readers Center, at our website, kojoshow.org. Going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with local author Elizabeth White, whose book explores the challenges she went through as a middle-aged person suddenly staring at unemployment. You can start calling about that now. Are you 55-plus and struggling to stay afloat financially? Tell us your story. 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nam.